Let's move into the business of the lecture today then, feminisms. You'll see immediately that I called this lecture not feminism, but feminisms, and that's because there are more than one kind of feminism. I want to, again, as I usually do, begin from a kind of general preamble. Rather like, you know, last week, if you remember, I did that slightly unusual thing when I talked about Marxism. I asked you to identify yourselves as Marxists, and of course, nobody, you'll remember, nobody identified themselves as a Marxist at the beginning of the lecture. Happily, of course, the lecture was so successful that you all now are Marxists. Feminism, I could begin by doing the same thing. I'm not going to, because I've done that trick. So I could begin with by talking about feminism in the same kind of way that I talked about Marxism. What I want to bear in mind, what I want you to bear in mind, is that rather unlike some of the other theories that we have discussed up until now, the one that I discussed with you last week, Marxism, and the one this week, requires, as it were, an explicit political commitment. Many people think of that as a commitment beyond the merely literary. Marxism and feminism would say that to put it in those terms, to say this is something beyond the merely literary, is to describe the political commitment to Marxism and or feminism as a kind of add-on to what you do as a literary critic. But for Marxism and feminism, politics is not an add-on. It was always there within the literature in the first place. So for Marxism, what you were encouraged to engage with is the idea, essentially, of class struggle as the most refractory, questions of ideology and so on, that are inscribed within the text as such, not something we add on to the text afterwards as a kind of optional extra. You know, you do your reading of the text and then you can choose to be a Marxist. Likewise, feminism. It's not the case that you do your reading of the text and then you can choose to be a feminist. Feminism here is a political commitment that comes first, as it were. There are various modes of that feminism. But feminism starts, like Marxism, from the premise that literature doesn't exist in a vacuum, that it exists in relation to, and indeed is a constituent part of, our historical being. Feminism is interested in history, as it intersects with the concerns and issues of gender, obviously. It asks the question, how is it that literature and the criticism of literature, our engagement with literature, our engagement with art in general, how is it that these things have been complicit with the self-evident oppression of women that shapes our culture and our society? Further, how is it possible to read in a way or to engage with culture in a way that will contribute to the emancipation of women rather than the incarceration of women? Feminism in general is opposed to patriarchy and sexism. So I was going to say Marxism, sexism. That would have been a gaffe. Feminist criticism is opposed to patriarchy and Marxism. So much, so banal. There are various ways in which it articulates that. One way that you will already know, because it is, as it were, a version of vulgar feminism, as we might call it, is concerned with images of women. You ask yourself the question, does EastEnders present strong images of women, good images of women? Yes, therefore, this is a good text. Well, images of women might be quite important, but it's hardly something that you would call theoretically sophisticated to proceed by just looking at the images of women presented in particular texts and to kind of tot up how many good points and how many bad points there are, and therefore to make a decision about whether the text is contributing to the emancipation of women or not. This, as I say, may be quite important, but it's not theoretically sophisticated. For the rest of the lecture, I want to talk about theoretically sophisticated modes of feminism, and in particular, that means the work of three very, very influential French feminists whose names are on the board. First of all, Luce Irigaray. Secondly, Hélène Cixous. And thirdly, Julia Kristeva, who is Bulgarian by birth, but now lives and works in France. So Irigaray, first of all. Irigaray, in her most influential texts, which are called This Sex Which Is Not One, that's the first one, and Speculum. Speculum is it's the term for a medical instrument that's used in gynecology. Speculum and This Sex which Isn't One. In these texts, Irigaray explores feminism from a psychoanalytical basis, combination of psychoanalysis and her own formation in French philosophy. She indicates that gender difference is an important issue in our unconscious as much as it is in our consciousness. And she begins from Freud. Gender difference, she notes, in Freud is primarily a visual thing. This is, as it were, a crude version of what is at stake in Freud. But let's stick with it for the purposes of simplicity at the moment. At a particular point, little boys and little girls are all running around, kind of vaguely looking at each other. And one day, the little boy stops and looks at the girl and thinks, oh, that's different. They're all naked. They're all naked running around, okay? The boy notices or sees that, as far as he understands it, the girl is a girl because she lacks the penis. Lack is something that we'll come back to. You know, women here know that you don't lack anything, of course, but in this way of construing psychoanalysis, this is the opening gambit. The little boy notices sexual difference and begins to construct the world in terms of males and females at that point. But it's primarily a visual thing. It depends upon the boy seeing or noticing this difference. At this moment, then, gender differentiation begins, and it's postulated upon what psychoanalysis came to call the gaze, a visual distinction, which enables the little boy to think of the girl as his other. It's the other against which he can define the self, and the self in this case is male. This, as it were, leads to a more general way in which we construct the world. We've talked about this before in relation to structuralism. We construct the world in terms of certain kinds of binary opposition. Well, the fundamental one here is the opposition between self and other. And we start from this realization that the boy sees a difference and identifies the girl as his other. His identity, therefore, is based upon the fact of his visual difference from the girl. Irigaray makes a bit of a leap from this moment to thinking about her philosophical training. And she thinks back to the great founder of modern French philosophy, Descartes. Descartes, many of you will know from philosophy, René Descartes. I'll just stick his name up on the board in case you don't. Descartes begins his philosophy, those of you who know philosophy know this, begins his philosophy by saying, how can I know anything about the world? I'm not very sure. How can I know, for example, that this fireplace that I'm sitting at, warming my feet at, is actually there? Because after all, last night, I was dreaming about a fireplace with my feet warming against it. How do I know that this fireplace is really there? He begins from the assumption that he cannot be absolutely sure about anything outside of himself. And he begins from a great process of doubt, the dubio, as it's called in Latin, I doubt. He doubts the existence of everything. He doubts the existence of everything outside of himself, then doubts the existence, indeed, of his own body. And what he's trying to do is to get to a position where he can say, there must be something of which I'm absolutely sure. And the thing of which he's absolutely sure is the fact that he is doubting. He says, even if I doubt that I am doubting, it remains true that I am doubting that I am doubting. So the dubio, the I doubt, becomes an absolute foundation of his philosophy. And it's based upon him looking at himself in relation to the world, trying to find himself, as it were, mirrored in or represented in the world. He looks at the world, cannot be sure of anything, but eventually turns inside and says, I'm sure of one thing, I'm sure that I'm doubting. And from that we get the famous cogito, I think, ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. Once he gets to that point, he's able to reconstitute everything, reconstitute the world, and so on. However, what Irigaray notices here is that this also is rather like the little boy looking at the little girl, looking at the world outside of himself in order to get a kind of confirmation of himself. And Descartes does it. By looking at the world outside of himself, by seeing this as a question fundamentally of representation and one where he's trying to identify himself in relation to that which is not himself, the other, the world, he's able to assume a stable identity, the thing that he calls the I, the self, we might later on call it, the subject of thinking. I am a thing that thinks, is how he puts it. Okay. So Irigaray says, isn't it interesting that in the whole tradition of Western philosophy, we find an idea that, or refer a mode of thinking, in which the representation of truth about the world is postulated upon exactly the same thing as we find in psychoanalysis that allows the little boy to identify himself as male. Fundamentally, a male philosopher reflects upon himself first and foremost, explores his own relation to that which is not himself, his other, and in these terms, woman becomes identified now as the other of thought as such. And we recognize this because we recognize this in cliched terms. We understand that woman is traditionally associated with not thinking, but with feeling, with not being sane, but with being lunatic, insane, irrational, governed by the moon rather than the light of the sun, governed by the rhythms of the moon, which are profoundly irrational, and which give us the word lunacy, of course, as opposed to those of us who are blessed with a penis or cursed with a penis, depending on how you look at it. Don't look at it. But who find ourselves in the position where we identify ourselves as male. But now, we identify ourselves not just as male. It's not an innocent sexual differentiation. I'm now identifying myself as the locus of thought. And all you women out there are the locus of something else. Emotion, not thought, as it were, the opposite of thinking. Women, then, is set as a kind of negative against the philosopher's positive. And this is the condition of patriarchal culture. In this state of affairs, the subject position, the word I, can be inhabited only by a male consciousness. That's the logic of the irigaray position. In these terms, woman is assigned to the position of the object or the other of the subject, and that means that women simply cannot be a subject in our culture. There's a significant sense in which women cannot say the word I unproblematically. And Irigaray says that in order for a woman to say the word I, typically in our culture, she has to inhabit or to mimic or to parody male speak. Every time a woman says I think such and such, because she cannot be the I as a woman, she has to, as it were, be something else. She has to not be a subject. In French, it's easy to write this because in French, the word for I is je, which has two letters, and she and her friend Monique Wittig, great novelist, starts to write it with a slash down the middle. The I, the female I, is fractured or fissured, cannot be present to itself. Women cannot be a subject. Thus, insofar as woman speaks, woman occupies or has to occupy a male position. And in doing so, woman is in danger of becoming complicit with her own oppression every time she speaks, even when she tries to critique patriarchy. In order to do it, she has to occupy a subject position that is structurally described as male. Clearly, women in this position have a major problem. Women cannot represent herself, is the logic of this position. Women has no voice as women. Remember, of course, the word vote is cognate with the word voice, comes from the same root. Representation, then, which is where all this begins, representation for Irigaray is what she calls an homosexualité. Is this thing going to fall? Hang on. Let me just write that up in the word. Okay, homosexualité. And she writes it like this. She writes the word homosexualité, but she sticks a second M in here in brackets. So it looks like homosexuality, as you know, comes from two words. Homos meaning the same, and sexuality meaning sexuality, funnily enough. But it's not just the same sex. It's the same male sex. Representation is about men representing themselves to themselves, confirming themselves as men. Therefore, representation as such is a particular kind of homosexuality, homosexuality that excludes women totally and categorically. Representation, therefore, becomes a male desire for the same. The pleasure of such self-representation is denied to women. All of this stems from the primacy of the visual. And therefore, for Irigaray, the primacy of the visual in our culture is a major problem. And so what she says is, remember, our body is conditioned not just by the eye, the ocular eye, but also by other senses. She indicates that while a man needs to have another against which to define himself sexually, that other that he sees in, you know, as a boy in the little girl, for example, a woman does not need an other. The man needs something outside of his body, she says, and he finds it in woman, or he finds it in the other that is the object, the world. A woman, because of the shape of her genitals, needs nothing outside of herself in order to define herself in gendered terms. A woman, unlike a man, is always in touch with herself. The shape of her genitals means, quite simply, that her body is constantly in touch with itself. What she says here is that the genitals are composed of two lips which are always in touch. And if we prioritize tactility, the sense of touch, then we can combat the primacy of the visual. She is always, according to Irigaray, in touch with herself. She has, as Irigaray puts it, erogenous zones all over. Sounds wonderful. And her sexuality, therefore, unlike the male's, which is focused on the primacy of the penis and the primacy of the visual, her sexuality is plural because of the multiplicity of erogenous zones, because woman is constantly in touch with herself. As I say, it sounds wonderful. Makes you kind of wish for something similar yourself. Importantly, theoretically, this plurality becomes the marker of a kind of femininity for Irigaray. Plurality becomes the key issue here, and it affects writing. Most importantly, what it means is, if we're going to be feminists, we cannot start from the priority of a notion called representation, because representation, as we currently think it, depends upon the primacy of the visual, the ocular, and is structurally masculinist. Okay. Let's move from that on to Hélène Cixous. I'll come back to some of this in Irigaray later when I'm trying to sum up towards the end. But let's come to Cixous. Irigaray's thinking and theorizing is based upon a whole series of binary oppositions. The principle that a thing can only be defined by reference to its opposite. Identity and difference, for example. Night and day, you know, the madness of lunacy and the moon against the clarity of the sun, which gives us enlightenment, and so on. Well, Hélène Cixous, when she thinks about this, starts to think that there's an awful lot of these oppositions. She lists a whole batch of them. Let me turn to you. You'll get this in her essay called Sortie. She begins Sortie by asking, where is she? And she sets up a whole series of binary oppositions. You can write them as two columns if you like. Activity against passivity. Sun against moon, culture against nature, day against night, father against mother, head against heart, the intelligible against the sensitive, logos against pathos. And she says here, we always have the same metaphor. We follow it, it transports us in all its forms, wherever a discourse is organized. The same thread or double tress leads us, whether we're reading or speaking, through literature, philosophy, criticism, centuries of representation, of reflection. Thought, she says, has always worked by opposition. And she goes on, it works by dual hierarchized oppositions, the superior over the inferior. Wherever an ordering intervenes, a law organizes the thinkable by oppositions. And all the couples of oppositions are couples. Does this mean something? She says. Is the fact that logocentrism subjects thought, all the concepts, the codes, the values, to a two-term system related to the couple, man against woman? When you look at her two columns, there's one column that is always seen as being superior to the other. And when you try to insert gender difference in those two columns, the male seems to be on the side of the one that that's always proposed as superior. Theory of culture, she writes, theory of society, the ensemble of symbolic systems, everything elaborates the same systems. And the movement by which each opposition is set up to produce meaning is the movement by which the couple is destroyed, a universal battlefield. Each time a war breaks out, death, she writes, is always at work. She describes this way of thinking as death-dealing binary thought. And it's death-dealing primarily because it's death to the possibility of women, who's always going to be the victim in this, or all going to be on the side of the inferior, the other, in this particular setup. So all of these oppositions are underpinned fundamentally by the opposition male against female. Sigsrud then argues that it's the very principle of binary opposition as a mode of our thinking which is the problem. Because that binary opposition will always be underpinned by that gender opposition that structures our world for us, male to female. So Sigsrud then postulates a different way of resisting patriarchy and masculinism. And her thought in this is an extension of the work of Jacques Derrida, about whom I'm going to speak in a later lecture when I come to talk about deconstruction. I won't go into this in too much detail because I'm going to give you the detail on it later. But in brief, she argues that we should not think in terms of simple binary oppositions as such, but rather we should think in terms of a multiplicity of oppositions. In this way, she's rather like Irigaray, going for a plurality of thinking as opposed to a singularity of thinking. Instead of her thought remaining within the binary couplet, she argues in favour of a rather generalised multiplicity of differences and distinctions. And the text that she favours is one rather like James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, in which there is little possibility of ever finding a self-identifying and unified sense, one single unified sense. I've brought two texts with me today to try to show you this, and I'm going to read you a little passage from both. I'll open Hanif Qureshi, that you're going to be reading in some detail later on in this particular module, and I'll open it at the beginning of the novel. Chapter 1. My name is Karim Amir, and I am an Englishman born and bred, almost. I'm often considered to be a funny kind of Englishman, a new breed, as it were, having emerged from two old histories. Now, it's quite easy to make sense of that, because, first of all, you've got the name, which individualizes the character. The character has a name, first of all, is not anonymous, has a particular kind of name that we associate with a particular kind of culture, and is an Englishman born and bred, almost. As we process that sentence, we make sense of it by having an opposition between English and foreign, English and the other, in particular, in this case, the other that's implied by the name, Karim Amir. And that's why you problematize the notion of the almost at the end of the sentence. I'm often considered, he writes, as if to explain this, I'm often considered to be a funny kind of Englishman. So again, we have another opposition. Straight Englishman, funny kind of Englishman. And we make perfect sense of it. Easy. Make sense of it by having binary oppositions. Here's the beginning of Finnegan's Wake, one of the greatest novels in the history of literature. River run past Eve and Adams, from swerve of shore to bend of bay, brings us by a commodious vicus of recirculation back to Houthcastle and environs. Sir Tristram, Violer d'Amores, for over the short sea, had passancore re-arrived from North Armorica, on this side the scraggy isthmus of Europe Minor, to wield or fight his peninsulate war. Nor had Topsawyer's rocks by the stream Oconee exaggerated themselves to Lawrence County's gorgios while they went doubling their mumper all the time. Now that's a wee bit more difficult. And it's a wee bit more difficult because the language of the text does not set up simple oppositions. There's not a simple opposition between, for example, America and Europe. Because it's not North America, it's North Armorica and Europe Minor. And in the word Armorica, we hear the Côte d'Armor of Brittany on the one hand, and we also hear America echoing in that word. So we don't know what Europe is being associated with or being opposed to in that sentence. We're used to the idea of a peninsula and a peninsular war. But what is a peninsulate? Penisolate? Penisolate? Pen isolate? Is it an isolated pen? Is it a pen that's something to do with a penis? Is it a penis that's something to do with a peninsula? is it that big? You know, how do you process this? The important thing is not that we arrive at a solution. The important thing is we realize there are multiple oppositions. That's the kind of text that Sig Su would regard as being marked by what she eventually calls an écriture féminine, a feminine writing, a writing that will not settle itself down into the simple death-dealing binary thought that you get in, quotes-unquote, more straight language. She likes that idea of a playful, disparate multiplicity of sentences, and she begins to identify it as specifically this notion that she calls an écriture féminine, a feminine writing. To be in touch with this writing, however, she argues, one must be in touch with the multiplicity of one's own body, one's own bodily identity. As a woman, this means not identifying the body only against the male body, but also relating it to and identifying it against a multiplicity of other bodies, including female bodies as well. It does not follow from this that what she's favouring is lesbianism, nor does it follow from this that she's favouring simple bisexuality. Rather, she's favouring something much more difficult to understand, a multiplicity of sexualities. It's a wee bit like Michael Stipe from REM was once asked explicitly about his sexuality, whether he was bi-curious, straight, gay, or whatever, to which his reply was, I'm a sexual being. And that's a wee bit like, I think, what Sig Su is trying to get at here. The multiplicity that's available through one's sexuality, through one's gender, in fact, especially if one is a woman. Woman's in a privileged position here because of the shape of her body. What's interesting here is that she's against the idea of identity as such. And in French, that means she's against the idea of what the French would call le propre, that which is proper to myself. She's against the idea of a property. She's against the idea of cleanness, netness, as you might think of it. She's against the idea of le propre. So we've had Irigaray against representation. We've got Sig Su against identity. Let me turn to Kristeva and try to extend this a little bit further. Julia Kristeva was an anarchist at one time, a long, long time ago, when she began her intellectual career. She then joined a group that was known as the Tel Quel group in France. Tel Quel is the name of a journal, and it was quite a radical journal in France, particularly in the 60s. It means such as it is, such as it is. And the Tel Quel group, it takes its title from a Paul Valéry text. The Tel Quel group were a very radical group of literary and cultural critics in France, particularly in the 60s. Tel Quel was a structuralist journal initially, and played a part in all that politicization of culture that I spoke of when I spoke of structuralism. It became explicitly Marxist and then became explicitly Maoist in its orientation. Kristeva wrote extensively for it. Her own background is that she was an intellectual in Bulgaria, and she left Bulgaria and didn't go back, stayed in France. When she came to France, she worked with Tsvetan Todorov and was influenced by Todorov's structuralist thinking and also has his emancipatory kinds of thinking. So she wrote extensively for Tel Quel, and she shared many of its political twists and turns. But in her most developed feminist theory, which, like Irigaray's, is very closely intertwined with psychoanalysis, traces of her role in anarchy reappear. As well as being a literary and cultural critic, she's also a practicing psychoanalyst, and she is still practicing as an analyst in Paris. She sees theory, especially the kind of Saussurean linguistic theory that dominated 20th century theory, as systematizing. It erects systems. And these systems, she thought, were oppressive and authoritarian precisely because they were systematic and claimed to be able to encompass every eventuality. Remember, she's coming from a quasi-totalitarian state, Bulgaria. She knows about how systems can impose themselves upon a culture and can strangle that culture. You know this in our contemporary world through the bureaucratization of culture, through the administered culture that we live in on a daily basis here, where everything you do has to, as it were, have a function, has to be accounted for, has to have certain kinds of accountabilities. As you know, in our culture, you can't as much as go to the bathroom without having a business plan for it, without saying how what your aims and objectives are going to be. And once you've done the business, you have to come back and write another business plan saying how you're going to improve your toilet habits next time around. And that way makes you an efficient member of a society. I parody it, but you know it. You know, you've all got your life plan sketched out for you. It's a way of thinking that is profoundly oppressive, and we know it as the administered culture or the bureaucratic culture. It's a systematization of thinking, which hampers freedom, of course. Christy Van knew all about this. She relates it primarily to the linguistics of Saussure, which does one thing, remember. Saussure prioritizes the langue over the parole, the general system of language, the grammar, over the individual speech act. Okay? And in doing that, it abstracts from the individual speech act, loses the specificity of the individual speech act, and immerses that in a general system of the language as such. Remember, think back to the structuralist lecture that I gave you on the difference between langue, the underlying system of language, the rules of chess, for example, and parole, the individual speech act. It's on the handout that I gave you for your formalism and structuralism lecture. Kristeva wants to shift attention back to the individual speech act, to the parole. She wants to shift attention back to the speaking subject, the I, which has caused so many problems for Irigaray, for Sigsu. The I that is fractured for Irigaray, the I that has a problematic identity in Sigsu. She wants to get back to that I and think about it as a speaking subject, the I which is implicit in any enunciation. Any statement made in speech, or indeed in writing, implies a position for its speaker. Not an identity for the speaker yet, simply a position from which the statement is possible, a position from which the statement could be made. I mean, banal example, the way that I'm speaking at the moment implies a position of English speakingness, so to speak. That's not my identity. My first language is a kind of bastardized form of this English thing, and I could speak in other languages if I so choose. But at the moment, all the stuff that I'm saying implies a position for the speaker, which is, quotes unquote, an English speaking position. Not an English speaking identity, but an English speaking position. Remember Irigaray's problem. There is no position from which a woman, as a woman, can speak and can make herself a subject. Kristeva works from the marginality of the position ascribed to women. And in that margin of culture, where we identify, you know, women, as we're always on the margins of our cultures, alongside women on the margins, she also locates people like dissidents, who also live on the margins of totalitarian cultures, radical intellectuals who live on the margins of banalized cultures, populist cultures such as our own, critical philosophers and so on, who are, as we all know, nutters, and therefore are somehow not part of the mainstream. You know, you see this, you can see it in a television debate. You know, on the one hand, it's like the great Monty Python sketch, we're arguing about the existence of God. And on the one hand, we've not been able to resolve this question about whether God exists or not, so this evening we're going to try to resolve it once and for all, and we're going to fight for it. In the red corner, we've got the Archbishop of Canterbury. In the blue corner, we've got the lunatic Marxist from the Trotskyite fringe. And you know which one is speaking the truth immediately. That's what I mean by saying these people are identified as on the margins of things. As a psychoanalyst, Kristeva starts by listening to her patients speaking. Psychoanalysis is called the talking cure by Freud, and the primary thing that the analyst has to do is to listen. And as an analyst, she's interested in the actual utterances and how those utterances are made by the patient. She's interested in where those utterances come from. A basic tenet of psychoanalysis is that as a child grows and is socialized, she or he must learn to temper their desires. Not every desire is or can be satisfied. However, the desires don't go away. They just relocate themselves in something that we call the unconscious. Freud shows how the stuff that we repress into our unconscious has a nasty habit of returning, often in the form of what he called parapraxis, what we know as slips of the tongue or slips of the pen, unintended things that come through, like my stuttering a moment ago. I said unintended things that come through. Why did I say through? Well, for Freud, for Kristeva, there is something that was blocking my straightforward saying of this. There is something that makes one hesitate, makes one stutter, that makes one sometimes say words and then have to correct them. The words, as it were, are coming from your unconscious. There's a pressure from your unconscious that's coming through those slips of the pen, slips of the tongue. The repress, therefore, returns to disturb... I can't do that. What I'm revealing to you in all this stuttering at the moment is that I am a nutter, that I have repressed so much in my unconscious. It's all coming back, and it seems to be always either with something that's got a th in it or a s in it. And I'm getting worried about it myself. There must be some... I'm lisping now. There must be something going on that is provoking that. I don't know what it is because it's in my unconscious. If you're a decent analyst like Kristeva, you'll listen and you'll note that. You won't say anything yet. You'll just note it and you'll think, aha. And I'll feel very uneasy as I begin to think, aha, she's saying, aha. Why is she saying, aha? And all this... Kristeva, rather like Freud and like Lacan, about whom I'll speak later as well when I talk about psychoanalysis, Kristeva operates on the hypothesis there are at least two significant stages in our linguistic development. At a certain point, the child acquires the semantic ordering of language that allows that child to make sense in the language that she or he is speaking. It's not that the child has lacked signifying abilities before that moment, it's just that they've been all rather disorganized. Instead of being able to say mother, the child says or mama or whatever. And you get these bizarre noises where the child is gradually learning to let the pressures that are coming from within herself emerge into an ordered form that we give the child by constant repetition. So when the child says, and we say, yes, mother. You know, how was that? You know, the child, what was that? Yeah, mother? Let me try it again. Mother. And gradually the child begins to imitate it. And we call that the entry into language. For many psychoanalysts, this is related to the Oedipal complex, which I'll talk about when I talk about in psychoanalysis. Let's not delay ourselves on that right now. The child then has always had disorganized impulses, disorganized desires that are, in a certain sense, pre-symbolic. They're not actually entering the symbolic order of things, the semantic ordering of things that allow us to make sense of the world as English speakers, for example, today. For Kristeva, the effect of language is that it enables the organization and direction of these impulses so that gradually the speaker can begin to identify this desire as anger, that desire as lust, this desire as hunger or whatever. And you get a word that you begin to use as a counter in our social context that allows us to make sense of lust, anger, hunger, and so on. And once we've got that language, we can act accordingly. Once I have the word that says, I am suffering hunger now, as opposed to, which is what I used to have, once I've got that word, I can begin to affect the world in a particular way. When I said that as a child, my mother probably had no idea what, you know, did I have colic? Was I hungry? Was I in pain? Was I dying? There's no way that she could really know what was going on. But once I get the word hunger, at that point I can organize the world and I can say, I am in hunger now, and she gives me food. So as it were, it shapes how we act and how we relate to the world. The child passes, therefore, according to Kristeva, from what she calls the semiotic stage into what she calls the symbolic stage. The symbolic stage is the stage in which we've organized these pulsions into something that is recognizable as language. The semiotic stage is something where we're just making signs, like or whatever. Doesn't really matter what the signs are, but they're just there as what we would recognize as semiotic counters. They don't have a meaning or a settled meaning. So the process whereby we make meanings and signify things involves the symbolic order and our manipulation thereof, but behind it is all the stuff that was there in the first place, those primary impulses that shape the semiotic order, the unconscious, as we would now call it. And every text therefore contains both of these things. Language becomes the site of struggles and power, and Kristeva, as a feminist, is interested most obviously in these issues of power as they affect gender. The semiotic, as I say, in Kristeva is linked to the pre-Oedipal stage, in which the infant experiences an endless flow of rather undirected impulses or pulsions or desires. These are gathered, she says, in what she calls the kora, which is a word that means something like... Oops, daisy, that doesn't work. Just broken that. It's a word... Here it is. No significance in the change of colour. It's a word that means something like the womb. All these things are gathered in the kora. And the kora is in close contact with the bodily flows and rhythms, the actual physiological body flows and rhythms. That's to say, the rhythm of your blood as it's pulsing around your body, the rhythm of your heart as it's beating, all these things that are fundamentally physiological. To enter the signifying process and to deploy what we usually think of as normal language, the semiotic kora has to be split or divided out, and that enables the organization of pulses into language, into some kind of order. But that entry into the symbolic stage, the stage into which we actually make these meaningful words, is marked fundamentally by the repression of the kora, the repression of the semiotic. But the semiotic will return, like every repressed, as a pulsional pressure in and on symbolic language. I'm going to go back now to Hanif Qureshi, and I'm going to read the same passage that I read in relation to Zixu. I'm going to extend it a little bit, and we'll show you how it is that this affects the way that Kristeva will hear this text. My name is Karim Amir. As I go through this, because I'm short of time, I'm going to artificially stress certain words, because I'm going to come back to them. My name is Karim Amir, and I'm an Englishman born and bred, almost. I am often considered to be a funny kind of Englishman, a new breed, as it were, having emerged from two old histories. But I don't care. Englishman I am, though not proud of it, from the South London suburbs and going somewhere. Perhaps it's the odd mixture of continents and blood, of here and there, of belonging and not, that makes me restless and easily bored. Or perhaps it was being brought up in the suburbs that did it. Anyway, why search the inner room? It's enough to say that I was looking for trouble, any kind of movement, action, and sexual interest I could find. Because things were so gloomy, so slow and heavy in our family, I don't know why. Quite frankly, it was all getting me down, and I was ready for everything. Then one day everything changed. In the morning things were one way, and by bedtime another. I was 17. On this day my father hurried home from work, not in a gloomy mood. His mood was high, and so on. You see what I'm doing here? It's the kind of thing at a banal level that you've learnt to do when you were noticed, I don't know, you must have been 14, and you were taught about alliteration and assonance. What I'm doing here is picking up on not the meanings of words, but the sounds of words, and noticing that exactly the same way as I seem to be having a difficulty this morning with my thys and my isses, my hissing and my thing, my thising and my thatting, here, Qureshi, as he writes, gives us words that are kind of echoing each other. Born, bred, breed, suburbs, bored. And what Kristeva would do in reading this text is hear that, not as a semantic thing, not as something that's containing meaning, but as something that is, as it were, a semiotic thing. Something that is revealing something else other than this manifest sense of this text. When I gave you it under the heading of Sigsu, I gave you the manifest sense of the text. Now giving it to you under the heading of Kristeva, what I'm trying to show you is that Kristeva can see the manifest meaning of the text, but she's also hearing this unconscious thing going on behind it. This unconscious thing, because she associates it with the Kora, because the Kora is associated with the womb, because the womb is associated with the pre-symbolic order, because all of these are associated with the body of women, all of that stuff, all of that semiotic stuff, is Hanif Qureshi's suppression of a certain feminine thing or series of things, a certain feminine aspect to the language. The task for the analyst here, the task for the feminist analyst, is to reveal, in this instance, something else that's going on within the language, and to reveal that that something else is connected to gender. So I go back to my initial gambit right at the very beginning of this lecture. It's not the case that feminism is an add-on, an optional extra. It's not the case that you can do a reading of a text and then think, and now we'll do a feminist analysis of it. You're either a feminist or you're not. If you are, you're interested in the emancipation of women and you're interested in the elimination of sexism and patriarchy. If you're not, then you better start justifying yourself. Thanks for your attention today and good luck with this work. Next week, I'm going to move on to psychoanalysis and we'll do some work on Freud and Lacan and fill in some of the psychoanalytic stuff that I started to hint at today. Thanks for your attention today and good luck.